WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're live again from the new studio of the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. And the studio is filled with people who've come to watch what they can usually only listen to. With us in the studio is the composer of the Fresh Air theme, Joel Forrester. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Terry. It's really great to be playing live.
And Joel will be back with us later in the show. And here in New York, perhaps the most original theater performance of the season is Fires in the Mirror. And with us is Anna Deavere Smith, who wrote and performs this one-woman show. It's about racial and ethnic identity. Much of the play is about the tensions between African Americans and Hasidic Jews in the Brooklyn neighborhood of Crown Heights. Smith tells the story from the perspective of over 20 different characters. Although she is African American, she inhabits the characters of Hasidic Jews as well as African Americans. All the characters Smith does are real people. The monologues are adapted from Smith's interviews with the actual people. Anna Deavere Smith, welcome.
Thanks.
To Fresh Air. And, you know, the Crown Heights story that you reconstruct during the play is basically this, and I'll give the real kind of stripped-down version of it. A Hasidic Jew in Crown Heights killed a 7-year-old African-American boy in an auto accident about a year ago. Later that day, in retaliation, a group of blacks stabbed a visiting Hasidic scholar. And there were just incredible racial tensions that have lasted ever since. What about that story made you think that you had to do something on it?
Actually, let me say quickly that the racial tensions
existed
had been
before,
brewing for
yeah.
about 20 years.
Yeah.
So this was the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak. Probably a bad metaphor for this. But at any rate, I was scheduled this year to create a piece like this based on interviews about Boston. This is a part of a series that I've been developing over 8 years called On the Road, A Search for American Character, where I go places and interview people and try to capture what I call the personality of the place by showing the diversity of its people. And frequently, I'm dealing with controversial event and trying to get varied points of view. And I thought that Boston would be the perfect place to go and do the Search for American Character, largely because of the amount of American history that's there. I was and am a fellow at the Bunting Institute, which is part of the Radcliffe-Harvard community. And however, Crown Heights had happened just before I moved east to take my fellowship. And it seemed to me that it was a real graphic example of the difficulties that we have with difference. I've never been in a community where difference is as obvious and as physical and as material. That is to say, that the Jewish people look like Lubavitch.
Yeah, these are the ultra-Orthodox
they're
Jews.
They're one sect of ultra-Orthodox Jews. And the African-Americans there and Caribbean-Americans, you know, obviously identifiable because of the color of their skin, but it's also a community where you can hear Caribbean rhythms, and I was saying that people all wore their roots on their heads. The Hasidim men had yarmulkes, the women had wigs, or the men had fedoras, and in the African and Caribbean American community, you saw dreadlocks, various African head dressings, women with shells in their heads, and I was really stimulated by those obvious differences. I think it takes a lot of guts to wear your roots on your head.
And you went around interviewing people from the Hasidic community and the African American and African Caribbean community,
right.
Caribbean American community,
mm-hmm.
And got their stories, edited what they told you,
right.
And became those people. You do
yes.
over 20 characters. You're going to do a couple of characters for us now. Is there anything else we should know before we hear you do them?
I don't think so. Maybe I'll just say their names and do them, and we could talk a little bit
great,
more.
Great, yeah.
Do you want me to do them both back to back?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, the first one is a young man. I'm doing, by the way, characters that I haven't done on the air very much, and they happen to be both young men. I think Henry, the first one, is in his early 20s. Henry Rice. I title every selection that I do because I think people speak in poetry, so that these monologues are small poems. I call this one Certain Words. He knew how to use certain words. How to Use Certain Words is the title. And Henry is now working for the National Conference of Christians and Jews. Okay. I knew I was going to have to be elusive, so I went back home and I got my bicycle. And I weaved around trouble. When things broke out, I moved forward. When things calmed down, when things broke out, I moved back. When things calmed down, I moved forward. And I was standing around talking to a group of little kids about voting, the power of the vote. And Richard Green came by, and he said, and I said, get away from me, you Uncle Tom. No, I said, go on, get back in your Mercedes-Benz. No, I said that to Clarence Norman. No, I said it to them both. And I was tearing them apart. But Richard Green was very persistent. He said, Mr. Rice, I like the way you speak. He said, I need your help. And, oh! And here in the show, Henry drops his food on it. He says, oh! It didn't get on me. But he said, I'm a community activist. I need your help. I didn't pay him no mind. But the next day was the day on Albany Avenue when the cops was out there chasing into the black crowd, not chasing into the Jewish crowd. And beating up black kids. And Richard Green came by in a yellow New York transportation van with the yellow lights flashing and a megaphone on the roof, the whole works. And he started calling out my name in the street, you know, Henry Rice. And at first I tried to ignore it, you know, but he kept on doing it. So I went over to the van and he said, Henry, I need you in this van. He said, come on, ride around with me tonight. Help me get some kids off the street tonight. So I said, okay. He said, the blood of the black man is on your hands tonight. I said, okay. So I get in the van, we're riding around, and I'm talking to the people on the loudspeaker, you know, mothers, please get your children off the street, you know, young people, please go back home. And I began feeling like I had to be there, you know, like the blood of the black man was on my hands tonight. And here he takes another bite of his hamburger. Richard Green sure know how to use certain words. Anyway, we get to Albany Avenue, and the cops was chasing these kids up the street. So I jump out the van with the portable megaphone. You know, I'm going like, don't run, and the cops won't hit you. You know, don't run, and the cops won't chase you. Next thing I know, cop comes along, hits me over the head with a stick, and handcuffs me. It takes a megaphone out of my hand. And I'm like, you know, I'm doing a community service for the mayor's office. They don't want to hear it. Matter of fact, they still have that megaphone to this day. So then I was like, Richard Green, would you come and get me out of this police car, please? So Richard Green came by, black captain came by, said, let him go. They let me go. Back in the van, another brother on the loudspeaker saying, nonviolence, peace. They started throwing rocks and bottles at the van. One young brother was so upset, he came over to the van with a 9mm fully loaded, said, get the hell out of this neighborhood. I told Richard Green, take me on home, shit. Next day, more fires, lootings, and the perception that black youths was going crazy in Crown Heights, like they was angry for no reason. So that's Henry Rice. And
you can do one of the Hasidic Jewish characters.
Yes, and this is also a young man, 17 years old, Reuven Ostroff, who works as an assistant chaplain in downstate Kings County Hospital, and I call this piece Pogroms. I work as assistant chaplain in downstate Kings County Hospital, and they asked me if Yonkel Rosenbaum had an autopsy, because in the Jewish religion, you're not allowed to have an autopsy, and I found out that he did. And I saw a Jewish man, a Russian man, sitting in a room down by the morgue, and he told me that his mother had committed suicide because she was terrified. And we were sitting in a room down by the morgue trying to get his mother not to have an autopsy. And he told me that his mother had come from Russia because of the hardships there, and that when this thing happened in Crown Heights, it was just too painful. And he said, it's like everywhere you go, there's Jew haters. He said, it's like you're trapped. And he said he woke up in the morning because the doorbell rang, and he went into his mother's room, and the window was open, which he thought was strange, because she was afraid of the cold even in the summertime. And he said he looked out the window, and there was blood all over the pavements, because she had landed headfirst on the concrete side of the apartment building. And the next day, we knew it was really getting serious, because Reverend Al Sharpton came down, Sonny Carson came down, started making pogroms.
One of the things I find really extraordinary about this performance that you do is that you really empathize with each of the characters that you do. At the same time, you have distance on them. And also, I think you find the basic truths and the basic absurdities in each point of view that you present. Is that like an ambition of yours to do that, to be inside and outside at the same time?
That's such a wonderful way. I mean, you're giving such a nice description of it. It wasn't my intent. My intent was to just try to give an accurate document of how someone said something to me in terms of a rhythmic, accurate, verbatim picture, speech picture. That's all I had in mind. However, I did do a show in San Francisco, in fact, called From the Outside Looking In. And I think as an artist and as a human being, I've frequently seen myself as someone who's on the outside and on the inside and moving back and forth across that line.
I wonder if doing a show like the one you're doing now makes you feel more hopeful or hopeless about people from different ethnic cultures ever comprehending each other. Because the worldviews of both the African-American and the Hasidic Jewish community are so far apart. And that is so revealed in the piece.
I don't know if I'm hopeful. I'm looking forward. I'm really intellectually excited by the challenge that we have in front of us to find new ways of talking about difference. And I really think that's happening, that people are. And I'm just excited because I think we're going to discover a whole new way to think and be about this.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and then I want to talk with you about language and how you use it and your voices. My guest is Anna Deavere Smith, and her one-woman show, Fires in the Mirror, has just been held over at the Public Theater in New York. This is Fresh Air. Back with Anna Deavere Smith and her show, Fires in the Mirror, just held over at the Public Theater in New York till August 16th. Now, you've all the characters you do in the show, you interview people, you transcribe what they tell you, and obviously you edit it, because as spoken as your stuff is, I know this from like transcribing interviews myself, that people speak really incoherently. And what you're doing is coherent. So you must really edit it a lot.
No, I try not to, actually. I just try to find a section in the whole interview that will stand on its own, because once I begin to cut and paste, it takes me away from the through line of their thought, which is what I'm trying to discover by, you know, sort of externally repeating what they've said. And I try to just find a section that I can take out just like it is. Sometimes I can't, because the other thing that I try to do in using, in this case, you know, 29 different selections, is to have a narrative, to tell a story. So each character has to push the story forward.
Part of what you're getting at is the way, the style of someone's speech, what that has to say about them.
It says everything as far as I'm concerned.
Can I ask you to do just a little bit of, there's a female rapper
right.
that you do in the show, and you really get into her sound, which is everything
right.
in rap.
Right.
And rap is just sound
sure.
language. So do a little bit of that
great.
For us and tell us how
okay.
you developed it.
And we call this piece Rhythm and Poetry. I'll just do a little segment I'm going into it. So my friends say, well, now, Mo, you know, Miss Mo, since you're so tough and so bad, how come you won't say nothing about Two Live Crew? When I talk about rap, I talk about people demeaning rap. I don't even mention them because they do not understand the fundamentals of rap. I mean, rap is basically broken down, is rhythm and poetry, you know. I mean, you know, poetry is expression. You can express anything through poetry. Poetry is intelligence. But if you ain't got a complex rhyme, I'm going to the store. What rhymes with store? More sore for more bore. I'm going to the store. I hope I don't get bored. What you saying, man? Who cares? No, you have to be deaf. D-E-F. Yeah, I guess I have to think of something for you, Terry, that's not slang. Deaf is dope. Dope is live. When you say something's dope, you mean it's the epitome of the experience. And we have to be deaf right now by our very presence, because we have to make people happy, because we are living in a society where people are not happy with their everyday lives.
That's great. Take us through the process a little bit. You spoke with her
yeah.
on tape, I imagine.
Right.
What happened next? What did you do?
I talked to her on tape. At that time, I was working on a show for the University of Pennsylvania called Gender Bending. And I, at the same time, interviewed a well-known scholar, Houston Baker, who, interestingly enough, writes about rap. And I thought it would be really exciting musically and intellectually to juxtapose his very beautiful academic speech, and he's a brilliant speaker.
But it's very
with
academic.
Monosyllabic vocabulary, as you might imagine, and an incredible facility for repeating details, and he has a lot of information. To juxtapose that rap discussion with Mo, so I took chunks of each of them and put them once against each other, trying to make an overall picture of what rap is. And that's basically what I'm always doing, is looking for segments of a person's speech that I know I'm going to juxtapose with something else. It's either going to be opposite what they're saying, or it's going to create a kind of a collage.
Do you, like, recite along with the person until you get it down? Do you talk along with the tape?
Oh, yeah. In fact, earlier you were talking about transcriptions. I really do a transcription as quite an afterthought. I just take the tape and put my headphones on and repeat what they say over and over again. When I was a young girl, my grandfather used to say to me that if you say a word often enough, it becomes you.
Right.
So that's my strategy.
Now, you have been an actress in other people's productions, mm-hmm. in addition to doing your own. I believe you were even on a few soap operas. Mm-hmm. How did you like working with the language, for instance, of soap operas, which I think has to be the most banal of...
I was never very good at
it,
because I was always trying to make more of it than was there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, you have to just be it.
An example of a line you had a struggle with in a soap opera that you couldn't
remember? God, I can't even think of one.
Okay.
However, on the other hand, when I worked on a play like Joe Turner's Come and Gone, Molly, who's a woman in red, who has a very small part and lines which seemingly... are very simple, I was shocked at how every word had incredible implications. And because, you know, it's really poetry, especially in Joe Turner's Come and Gone, the language. So there's sometimes that what I do, which is taking the what would seem to be the simple language of people and trying to understand the poetry of it, actually helps me when I do the work of some authors.
Now, let's get back to the theme of your show, which is ethnic identity and ethnic differences. Why is that an important issue for you? Did you go through something in your life that made that really resonant?
Well, that's I suppose a long and complicated question. Race is my work. It has become my work. I don't think I necessarily set out to have it be my work. Although, when I was in high school, I knew that I wanted to do something that had to do with people talking to one another, because I grew up in during the civil rights movement. I didn't know what that was. I thought I wanted to be a linguist, and then I found out what linguistics was, and I didn't want to be a linguist. I just knew that I wanted to speak in multiple tongues, and I've eventually left the study of foreign languages, which is what I set out in order to do that. I thought maybe I would be a translator at the UN or something like that, and I find that in English we're ultimately speaking so many different languages that I have quite enough work to do right here.
Right. I've been reading a little bit about you, and I know that at some point, I think your family moved into a predominantly white neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably when you were in junior high or something.
Actually, high school, yeah.
That's a pretty self-conscious period of somebody's life.
Mm-hmm.
Did that create any kind of identity crises within you?
I think more shocking was really when I went to an integrated junior high school before we actually moved.
Uh-huh.
And, I don't know if it'd be as shocking now, but when I was growing up, my mother, for example, tells a story of taking me to stores and the people, African Americans couldn't try on the clothes. And the ladies would say things to her like, oh, well, she looks clean. Let's sneak her in. Let me try on the clothes. And my brother, my younger brother, has blonde hair and blue eyes. And I have heard several stories of people coming up to my mother and saying, "My God, where did you get that pretty little boy?" And at first I thought, well, it's all about Diva being so pretty, and now, you know, I'm just holding on to the back of her dress, nobody cares about me. But no, what's interesting about that story, I realize now, is the use of the word get. You know, and I don't know what was going on. And we had a good friend across the street, a very light-skinned boy, whose mother gave him a spanking in a department store. And all of these white women came over and chastised her, because I guess they assumed that she was the maid and that this child wasn't her child. So, I mean, that's like what I grew up in my life's work. My life's work as a human being has been to resolve much of that and to find a way of living in a society which has different kinds of people.
I'm wondering if being light-skinned African-American has put you kind of in the middle in a way.
Not ultimately. I mean, ultimately, Ultimately, you know, I'm African American.
Oh, no, I realize
no,
that.
But I mean, ultimately, I think I'm, no, yeah. I don't think, I shouldn't say that so quickly, but ultimately, I think still some of the same kinds of things play out for me that do for other darker-skinned African Americans. There is a kind of way that aesthetically I am in the middle, so that when I got out of acting school, the first agent that I ever went to said to me, well, I couldn't possibly send you out because I don't want to offend my clients. They wouldn't know what to do with you. What are you? What would you go as?
Wow.
And one agent here in New York who said, I think you should try to pass as Spanish.
Love stories like that. Oh, well.
Aren't they good? Yeah. I haven't had a chance to tell any of those. Thanks, Terry.
So I haven't mentioned, but you're a professor of acting, I believe, at Stanford.
Yeah, I'm an associate professor of drama.
Do you feel like going back to the classroom after this great reception you're having on stage?
Well, first of all, so many of my students have come. And
I've left you about 15 seconds for this
it's
answer.
It's so wonderful. But yeah, I think the classroom is the only place still that you can experiment in theater. Really is. Really is.
And do you want to perform in anybody else's plays anymore?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm waiting for the phone calls on that one.
Well, I'd love to see you in as many contexts as I can. I think the show is absolutely wonderful. Your performance here was terrific. Thank you very, very much for being with
Thanks
us.
Thanks for having me.
And Anna Deavere Smith's one-person show is called Fires in the Mirror. It's been held over at the Public Theater in New York through August 16th. And then, by the way, she's taking it to Los Angeles in September. To the Mark Tabor Forum?
No. Actually, I'm going in September to do interviews about the riots in L.A. to do a piece, but to ART in September, Fires in the Mirror.
Very good. Okay. Best of luck to you, and thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, we're live today from the Museum of Television and Radio in New York, and our composer of the Fresh Air theme, Joel Forrester, is with us. I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air, and I'm going to ask Joel Forrester to play us out.